Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Over the weekend, thousands of hackers, journalists, lawyers, researchers, and computer security professionals descended on Las Vegas for DEF CON, the world's longest-running and largest hacking conference. It's gotten to be a very big event, with panels, partying, and even some live hacking-themed hip-hop. Hack all
the things! You know there's gonna be security, right?
First we drink all the booze, then hack all the things, then backdoor the firmware on anything you bring, regardless of the hardware, service, or encoding.
It's been going on for a long time. The first DEF CON was held in June of 1993, but things have changed since then. Election security is front of mind after the 2016 election and new warnings from U.S. intelligence officials that Russian actors are attempting to disrupt the midterms, too.
I'm very concerned for our upcoming election because this voting machine is used in 18 different states, and it's extremely easy to get admin access on this machine. So let me show you how quick it is.
That's Rachel Toback, the CEO of a cybersecurity company called Social Proof Security. And in this video she posted to Twitter, Toback is standing before a big rectangular voting machine.
And now I have full admin access, under 2 minutes.
2 minutes to potentially undermine our country's democratic system without much more than a ballpoint pen. And it kind of makes you question the security of your vote, right? Election and state government officials rejected the public show. A statement by the National Association of Secretaries of State asserts that DEF CON utilizes a pseudo-environment which in no way replicates state election systems, networks, or physical security. We will put that claim to Colorado's Secretary of State Wayne Williams in just a minute. But first, I'm turning to David Kennedy, and he's a former hacker for the National Security Agency and the Marine Corps. And David also served as the chief security officer for Diebold, which manufactured voting equipment. And today, he's the CEO of Trusted Sec, an IT security consulting company. David, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So we've heard that it seems pretty easy to physically hack into voting machines. We've seen reporting that says that in about 18 states that's happened. How concerned should we be about the security of our systems based on this? What does this tell us?
Well, it is alarming, especially what we saw in the 2016 election cycle with Russia. Russia had a very big interest in how we conducted our election process. It doesn't mean that they were able to change any votes. There's been no evidence of that. What's actually going for us is that all of the states run their own type of equipment, have their own types of processes, and it's actually very complex in each individual state. So to do a sheer mass hacking campaign against the entire country would be really difficult. But if they start focusing on things like swing states and other locations that may have a major impact, those are things that Russia categorically looks at from an intelligence perspective and says, hey, is it possible for us to possibly change the election? Is that something that we want to do? And these systems, even if you look at Georgia, for example, Georgia is actually using the old Diebold AccuVote TSX systems primarily as their main voting machines that haven't been updated since 2009. They're very ancient, out of date. They don't have a lot of security features built into them. And these are things that are definitely very concerning from a security perspective and things that we should be extremely concerned about going forward into different elections. One thing I can say, though, is that the government is trying to, both at a state and federal level, trying to protect these systems. And so there's a lot of proactive features going on to try to combat these in the future.
So you mentioned Russia, and I just want to go back for a second. Last year, there was a classified National Security Agency report that was leaked to a news organization called The Intercept about regarding the Russian hacking of the 2016 elections. It did say that Russian military intelligence attempted to hack a voting software company. Do we know anything else about the specifics of what they did?
I don't think the intention was to actually change voter count in one way or the other. But it doesn't mean that Russia wasn't interested in being able for the ability to change votes or whatnot. It's just that they didn't have the capabilities at the time of doing it. These are all things that the government's really taking into concern right now and trying to work with. But it's something that we don't really have a good game plan for because these states are typically well understaffed when it comes to what they have to do for security. So it's something that in the security industry we were very concerned with. And what was actually represented at DEF CON, which is a big hacker conference, conference in Las Vegas, where they actually had a voting machine hacking camp where people can come in and actually try to attempt to hack older systems that they're able to get their hands on. It's definitely something that we need to be concerned with. We need to continue to raise awareness around this and hold our representatives very accountable for these types of things. I mean, democracy is obviously very important to us. If we can't trust our voting process, and especially with electronic voting, that's a major problem.
Also, I want to sort of talk a little bit about the tension that you're raising here between, I mean, we know that there isn't a national organization or agency that is set up to guarantee election safety because all of this is done on a state-by-state level. But the bigger question is, if we end up with some federal sort of oversight on this, or using, as you mentioned, similar technologies across different states, would that then open us up? Would that make us more vulnerable?
I think the whack-a-mole system right now is actually helping us because it's so decentralized and every state does something completely different. And what we're seeing now with the federal government, the state level, is they have a very difficult time understanding security and building security into their overall infrastructure. And that's a major concern. So if you centralize it, it would have to be a governing body that focuses on the safety, security, and the integrity of those voting machine systems, and that there's enhanced logging so they can see if there's tampering on those devices. There's enhanced controls to detect intrusions as it's occurring. It would be a massive undertaking. And I believe it's something that should actually happen. There should be a central governing body that focuses on the standards and accreditation of these systems state by state to ensure consistency across the board. But until that's up and running, it's actually playing in our favor a little bit to have a decentralized model. But that's only going to last so long. With 2016 and the emphasis of Russia, you have nation states that have, you know, hundreds and billions of dollars to focus on these types of campaigns. Now, we should be really alarmed about that. And if they're going to be upticking it in this 2018 election and in 2020, that's going to be a major problem for us. And the decentralized model may not help us in this case.
Now, how do we go about putting in some measures here? I mean, I've seen everything from people suggesting we return to paper ballots in certain areas. I mean, is that really realistic? What are we looking like in terms of our security heading into the 2018 midterms?
I'm actually a huge fan of paper ballots. The amount of fraud that occurs on the paper ballots are substantially lower than a potential for a hacker to come in and actually go and hack those systems. Now, is that feasible? It requires more manpower, requires more people, or it would probably require more funding. But we did use that prior to the 2016 election, so it's definitely doable and possible. I don't know if electronic voting is the right method right now until we can get our hands around the protections that we can put in place to ensure that votes can't be changed. And again, I want to emphasize that these systems are very isolated and segmented, so it would take a lot for it to happen. But still, that possibility of it occurring is something that we should all be concerned with, and something that we should consider alternatives to until we have a good, reasonable level of assurance that it can't happen.
David Kennedy is a former hacker for the NSA and the Marine Corps. David, thanks for the information.
Thank you.
Not every state feels unprepared for the midterm elections. Colorado was among the 21 states targeted as part of the Russian interference campaign in 2016. And since then, they've done more than perhaps any other state to safeguard against election hacking. Wayne Williams is the Secretary of State for Colorado, serving since 2015. Secretary Williams, will Colorado be the safest state to cast a vote this November?
Dan Zeta, thanks for having me on. Yes, we will be.
All right.
And beginning when I took office in 2015, we actually began to establish a series of protocols. I adopted new voting system standards, so every vote cast in Colorado is cast on a paper ballot. We have then even gone further and established the nation's first risk-limiting audit, where we actually compare how the machine interpreted a vote with the actual paper ballot for that cast vote record. And so I can tell you that nobody in Moscow, Beijing, or anywhere else hacked a single vote in the state of Colorado.
All right. Well, that's pretty reassuring. Now, I want to go back a second to, we sort of led the beginning of the show today with this DEFCON conference, where there was apparently some voting systems that were hacked into in less than 2 minutes. Do you worry about that? I mean, I know you said you guys are using paper ballots, but ultimately we're all headed in this direction of electronic voting. Do you worry that the systems are that easily hacked?
So I am concerned about any system that does not have a paper record, something and that the voter can themselves verify and ensure that the machine correctly interpreted their vote. In Colorado, we established that. So we had moved where we had some places where there was not an actual paper ballot. We did have a paper record, but not the actual ballot. I shifted to actually having the paper ballot. So I don't think we are moving towards an all-electronic system, and I'd be very wary of standards that did that. The other thing I'd note is, you know, where you see someone given access, or as I listened to the music opening, talking about everything connected to the internet, well, in Colorado and in almost every other state, voting machines are not connected to the internet. That's an important safety precaution. You actually have to be physically present at the polling place or at the central count center in order to change anything in the machine. And that's important. We have security protocols for that. We have video surveillance. We have a host of processes there where we don't let someone, even the 2 minutes that the hacker referred to, we don't give them 2 minutes of access to a machine. We don't let you come in and play with it. We have security protocols in place. But above and beyond that, that paper ballot with the risk-limiting audit provides that assurance that nothing did happen.
Well, and we know that each state has its own election mechanics and systems in place. But at the federal level, earlier this summer, Congress failed to pass a bill that would have provided $250 million in grants to states for new technology to guard against these types of cyber attacks. Do you think that there needs to be a bigger sense of urgency at the federal level at this point, given the concerns about hacking in other states in particular?
Actually, earlier this year, Congress did finish funding the Help America Vote Act and so provided millions of dollars to states for funding. There was then a more a political ploy than an actual attempt to fund that took place because Secretaries of State weren't even consulted about the potential legislation someone threw out on the floor. I think the organized way that the federal government has assisted has been helpful. And I'd note that the Department of Homeland Security has played a key role. They have had many different programs. So we've had representatives, hackers from them, in our office on two separate occasions reviewing our systems, making sure everything's correct. You mentioned, by the way, the Russians attempting to infiltrate voting registration systems. There were 21 states at least where that occurred. That's not the same as the tabulation system. Voter registration systems are connected to the internet because you can register to vote online. Colorado established two-factor authentication a number of years ago, so even if you have a password, you can't change that voter registration system without the second factor. It's one of the other security precautions that states need to adopt, and many are across the country.
Well, and as you mentioned, I mean, there's a difference between accessing the actual tallies and then accessing the systems that allow people to register to vote. But we should reiterate, just to be clear, that there was no evidence that the votes were altered in 2016. The impact, however, on constituents and on Americans, psychologically at the very least, seems to have been pretty intense. We're looking also at, you know, we've heard a lot from our callers who say they don't believe their vote is secure, obviously with these claims about fake news and voter fraud and, you know, coming from the administration. How do you restore the trust that American people can have in this democracy?
Tanzina, that's actually the key point. You have to have processes in place that people can have confidence in. That's why we shifted to a voter verifiable paper ballot. It's why we established a risk limiting audit where we can guarantee you that nobody changed a single vote in Colorado. And you ultimately have to have that voter confidence. That's what our democratic republic's based on. You have to have people who believe that their vote counts, so they will take the time to vote. It's one of the reasons why Colorado has the highest voter participation in America.
Wayne Williams is the Secretary of State for Colorado, serving since 2015. Wayne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
In Afghanistan, a fierce battle between government forces and Taliban insurgents continues. The Afghan Minister of Defense estimates that roughly 200 Taliban fighters have been killed since Friday when the Taliban launched a major assault against the city of Ghazni, the capital of the Ghazni province in southeastern Afghanistan. Dozens have also died on the Afghan side. It's another development in the Taliban's ongoing effort to wrestle control from the Afghan government. 60% of Afghan districts are currently under government control, leaving 30% contested and 10% firmly under the control of the Taliban. Michael Semple is a leading expert on the Taliban, and he's a professor at Queen's University in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So, Michael, give us a sense what's motivating the Taliban with these specific attacks in the country.
This is a major show of strength put on by the Taliban. They know that they cannot take and hold an Afghan city like Ghazni, but they've demonstrated they can fight their way in there and that they can target any person, and particularly any member of the security forces located there, even if they know that they have to withdraw a few days later.
Why are they taking this approach? I know you've been in touch with members of the Taliban. What can you tell us about their strategy here?
They're trying to win a war. One of the ways in which they feel that they can win the war is by intimidating anybody who stands up to them. They're trying to crush resistance. In moving into Ghazni, clearly they want to show members of the security forces and people who cooperate with the government that they're not safe anywhere. So that's their short-term objective, is to go after members of the security force. Longer term, they are trying to wait out the Americans. They believe that if it's a straight fight between them and the Afghan government, they expect that they will be able to win. At the moment, the Afghan government is being supported by the US. They're basically trying to say, we will wait them out. We will overthrow the government as the Americans leave.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, the Taliban is trying to win a war, but there have been reports that are saying that the AP, for example, said the Taliban claims to have met with the top U.S. diplomat. The U.S. is saying they haven't confirmed that meeting. Are there any hopes of peace talks with the Afghan government or with the United States?
Quite some time ago, both the United States and the Afghan government reached the conclusion that there is no military solution to this conflict. They have therefore, in their own ways and often in partnership, have been trying to set off peace talks. I believe that some form of talks have been taking place, but they've really been very preliminary. And the US attempt in that is to try to persuade the Taliban to move towards negotiations with the Afghan government. This is where we have the issue. The Taliban movement have said that they are prepared to talk with the US. They claim that they are fighting against the US. They want to talk with them. They do not recognize the Afghan government. The trouble is that the Taliban leadership has not yet reached the conclusion that there is no military solution. They are still banking on a military solution. Therefore, they have held out from participation, in a sense, in sincere peace talks with the Afghan government. So if we take the example of the military operation over the past few days, of course, Taliban strategists, you know, they came up with this rationale which I just gave to you. But if you look at what's happened over the past few days, the reality is that the center of Ghazni has been burnt to the ground. That has been a loss of millions of dollars, destroyed the livelihoods of thousands of Afghans. And again, you know, so, and what's there to gain from it? Okay, it may have looked good as far as a military tactic, but the reality is destroyed lives, and it does not actually bring them towards any kind of victory or a resolution of the conflict. So, of course, a negotiated settlement will be the way. But so far, the U.S. has not managed to come up with any persuasive arguments for the Taliban. Ultimately, it is right-thinking members of the Taliban movement themselves persuading their leaders, and also members of the population who the Taliban are courting. They're the ones who are going to have to turn the leadership around and persuade them to enter a negotiated settlement.
Michael Semple is a professor at Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
On Monday, the U.S. Air Force and elements of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division were called in to support Afghan forces with the siege of Ghazni. It was the latest show of American force in a country that we've been at war with for 17 years. Now, the Trump administration is pursuing a radical reversal of strategy, directing American diplomats to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table for direct talks on a path to peace. But will it work? Andrew Shaver is a lecturer at Dartmouth College and the director of the Political Violence Lab. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tenzina. Thank you for having me.
So it seems like a pretty basic question, but as I mentioned in the intro, we've been here for 17 years. Why are we still in Afghanistan? And what is the central goal of U.S. forces in Afghanistan?
That's an excellent question, and you're right. It's a war approaching 17 years. I won't speak, of course, or I'm not in a position, rather, to speak toward the formal U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, but what I can reflect on is the history of the conflict and U.S. engagement there. It began, as many of your listeners will recall, with an effort to expel Al-Qaeda, rather, from Afghanistan, which had been operating under the auspices at the time of the Taliban. And so the conflict began very much as a counterterrorism campaign, but very quickly moved into a counterinsurgency fight against the Taliban itself. At the time, the Taliban was seen as sort of harboring, aiding, and abetting Al-Qaeda. And so for the past 17 years, we've effectively been engaged in a long-scale counterinsurgency campaign with the Taliban.
Now, I want to assume that the United States didn't expect to be here for 17 years. Again, I don't have any insight into that. But I guess the wondering, is this a sign that the Taliban is actually stronger than American U.S. forces had anticipated if it's taking us 17 years in this conflict?
I think that's exactly right. So we know a number of things from academic research and, of course, from experience fighting insurgencies. One of those is that countries that have rugged terrain tend to be auspicious to successful insurgency campaigns. Afghanistan is an incredibly rugged country. Insurgency campaigns in which insurgents have access to contraband financing, access to foreign soil where they can take refuge, again, tend to make for more intractable conflicts. And that's precisely what the United States and its international partners have encountered in Afghanistan.
We're seeing the latest moves here of the Taliban in Ghazni. How strong is the Taliban in Afghanistan?
That's an excellent question. You mentioned in the conversation with Professor Semple some of the statistics around Taliban control of Afghan territory and some 30% of the territory being disputed at this point or contested. At the end of Operation Enduring Freedom, which came to a conclusion at the end of 2014, the U.S. Defense Department released to me sort of highly detailed statistics on the war, and it provides this really remarkable insight into the dynamics of the U.S. fight and the Afghan fight against the Taliban. And what the data really show is the Taliban has been a remarkably resilient fighting organization. The data show that in spite of the U.S. troop surge, the Taliban was able to sort of persist in carrying out tens upon tens of thousands of attacks against counterinsurgents. And some of the statistics that are sort of notably concerning are around casualties. We see in the post-surge period a reduction in the number of U.S. casualties, which makes sense because the U.S. was significantly reducing its troop presence. But what we see is a much larger increase in the number of casualties being sustained by Afghan police and military forces.
That can't be helping our relationship with the Afghan government or with the Afghan people.
Certainly not. I mean, the idea was, could you increasingly turn security affairs over to the Afghans so they could effectively at some point sort of manage security affairs for themselves? And that has come necessarily at the sort of cost of Afghan forces being more and more engaged in the conflict and then, of course, incurring more of the costs of that.
And you mentioned our troop levels in Afghanistan. How much have they changed under this new administration?
So I believe at the end of last year, the U.S. Defense Department gave an official number of some 13,000 troops in the country, if I recall correctly. That number has probably shifted upwards somewhat over the last year, or the last 6 months, rather. But I think the more relevant statistic here isn't troop levels over the shorter term, but looking sort of at the past 17 years. At the height of the deployment of International Security Assistance Force troops, so that's primarily the United States, but a number of NATO partners as well, there were some 132,000 troops deployed. And so the real kind of contrast here is between having at one point 132,000 troops deployed in this counterinsurgency fight versus some 10 or 15,000 now.
What type of leverage, if any, does the United States have to actually have negotiations with the Taliban at the end of the day, if that's ultimately going to be a new strategy?
This is really tricky. So the U.S. government, in sort of signaling its resolve by committing more troops, by indicating that it's sort of willing to stick out the fight, that potentially is a costly signal to the Taliban that the United States is sort of willing to stick around long enough and incur the cost that, you know, it's serious about a negotiated settlement and the Taliban might want to think kind of more deeply about whether it wants to sort of continue to sustain the strategy, as Professor Semple mentioned, of sort of waiting out the American presence. But yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation.
Andrew, as I mentioned at the top of the segment, we've been in this conflict for 17 years. It's almost hard to believe. Is there a likelihood that we could be a permanent fixture in Afghanistan?
I think there's a likelihood that the United States will remain deployed in some capacity, even if there was some sort of negotiated settlement that called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops in exchange, for example, for the Taliban laying down arms and potentially, you know, agreeing to some sort of political resolution. It's hard to imagine a situation in which the U.S. doesn't remain, at least in some limited capacity, to, again, to at least advise, to assist, to train Afghan forces. But these are all points that would be, I guess, spelled out in any kind of negotiated settlement if anything were to be reached.
Andrew Shaver is a lecturer at Dartmouth College and the director of the Political Violence Lab. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A firefighter was killed last night while trying to contain the Mendocino Complex fires in Northern California, one of 19 wildfires burning across California right now. At least five firefighters have died in the state this summer. Down in Southern California, however, more than 1,400 firefighters are battling the Holy Fire, which has burned more than 30 square miles. Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency in Orange and Riverside counties, and CAL FIRE issued a mandatory evacuation for thousands of residents. Helen Zarb-Kazin and Sharon Holmes did not have to evacuate their homes near Lake Elsinore, but they watched the scene unfold from their mobile home park.
Oh, it was horrible last night.
Nightmare. Have you seen the movie Inferno? Anyway, it's an old movie called Inferno, and that's what it was, the Inferno.
It was horrid here.
Jill Rep-Logal spoke to the women on Friday, and she's the Orange County reporter for KPCC. Jill, welcome.
Hi, happy to be here.
So give us a sense of Helen and Sharon when you spoke to them. Give us the picture of where they were when you got to them. What did the area look like?
They live right across the street from the evacuation zone, and the hills above Lake Elsinore are very steep. It goes straight up to the mountain. And so from the communities around the lake, they were watching basically throughout the night as flames were creeping closer and closer to the lake and to the neighborhoods around the lake. One of the women had a daughter who was in the evacuation zone, so she was obviously very concerned. And, you know, they said from night to the next morning, it was just night and day in terms of getting control of the fire. But that's what happens with fires around here, especially in this area. They tend to pick up in the afternoon when the winds pick up and the temperatures rise, and then they'll sort of die down in the morning, and it turns into a constant daily battle for firefighters.
So we've talked a lot about the fires that are happening in Northern California, but tell us what's happening in Southern California and Riverside and Orange County specifically.
This one is about 60% contained at this point, which is pretty good. So, and that means that firefighters have gotten a handle on 60% of the perimeter of the fire. There is still one highway closed, which is causing a lot of people problems. They're having to do, you know, a big sort of drive around to get to work and things that they need to do outside of the mountain.
Now, Orange County officials have charged the man with arson in connection to the Holy Fire. What do we know about Forrest Gordon Clark, the man who's been charged?
He lived in a kind of remote canyon area where there are a lot of people who don't want to live next to a lot of other people. He was known to be very combative. He feuded with his neighbors a lot. He was known as an eccentric. He had also texted some threats to the volunteer fire chief of Holy Jim Canyon, where he lived, threatening to burn the place down. So it wasn't a hard find to think that he had done it. He says he didn't do it, but there seems to be a lot of evidence pointing in his direction.
What does this look like going forward? I mean, we're still in the month of August. There's a couple more hot months to come for the state of California. Are we expecting more wildfires?
I mean, the real fire season in California usually starts between September and October. This is not usually when big fires start in California. That's what's made this summer so unusual. And, you know, resources being taxed to this early in the season could really spell trouble later in the year. I mean, mostly for firefighter fatigue. I mean, people have been coming in from different states and all over the state of California, and even I think from a few different countries, which is great. But, you know, the question is how long can these resources keep up when things are really supposed to pick up, usually pick up around September and October. And that's because that's when temperatures really rise. That is actually the hottest part of our year here in California. And these dry, hot winds blow down from the mountains called Santa Ana winds in Southern California. And that's when everyone knows that fire is really a danger. So the fact that it started this year in July is just incredible.
Well, we'll be paying very close attention. Jill Replogle is the Orange County reporter for KPCC. Jill, thanks for keeping us up to date.
You're welcome.
So last week, a group of leading international climate scientists released a new report. They laid out research on what they call hot house Earth. It's a theory that if humans heat up the planet just a few degrees more, the world's natural systems will begin to break down and trigger a domino effect. That leads to accelerated warming of the atmosphere. And a planet that's unrecognizable by today's standards. It sounds catastrophic, but is there really no return? I spoke to Diana Liverman. She's a professor of geography and development at the University of Arizona and one of the authors of this new report. And I asked her how the hot house Earth scenario is different from what we already know about our warming planet.
Well, for a long time, scientists have been predicting that if we put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we're going to warm it. We're already starting to see that. We've warmed the atmosphere by 1 degree. But what happens with hothouse Earth is by warming the planet, we actually kick off some feedback processes that add to our warming. So, for example, as we warm the planet, the permafrost, frozen ground, starts to melt, and that puts methane up into the atmosphere, which is also a greenhouse global warming gas, and that adds even more warming. So hothouse Earth is our contribution to the atmosphere, plus what we trigger in the natural system in terms of what we call feedbacks that then make it even warmer.
Is it something that we're dealing with now, or is this something that could happen in the future?
Well, we haven't actually triggered any of the rapid feedbacks yet, but some of the parts of the Earth system that are warming are starting to show signs of beginning those feedbacks. So we're already starting to see the melting of frozen ground in the Arctic. We're starting to see the disappearance of Arctic sea ice. And even those right now are gradual. They're the beginning of the feedbacks that could take us to hothouse Earth if we don't do something to reduce our impact on the atmosphere.
And how many years do we really have before this starts kicking in full time? I would imagine that a lot of folks think that we're already there.
Well, we're already there in terms of warming the planet, but in the paper, we don't suggest that we're already there in terms of the feedbacks kicking in, that reaching some of these thresholds. We suggest that perhaps we've got 1 to 2 decades as we start to get near 1.5 degrees of warming, and probably for sure by the time we get to 2 degrees of warming, then we would have chosen the path that takes us to hothouse Earth. But we still have time to choose another trajectory towards what we call stabilized Earth, which are much more livable system.
I want to ask you a question about the current climate situations. We're seeing the heat waves in Europe and different parts of Asia, the just instability across the board, the largest wildfire in California's history ever burning right now. Are these related to the hothouse Earth effect in the early stages?
Well, we can't make a direct link, but what scientists can say is that by warming the planet, we've increased the chances of what we're seeing right now, and that what we're seeing right now is definitely the sort of warming that and the sort of impacts that we would see as if we move on to the hothouse Earth trajectory. So doing a direct sort of attribution is quite difficult, but in terms of probability, we've definitely increased the chances of the heat waves and their impacts that we've seen this summer.
So on the one hand, we've talked a lot about, just generally speaking, the negative impacts of climate change, including and a lot of the worsening impacts that we could see if we actually enter into this hothouse earth effect. And many of those include insect infestations, wildfires, droughts. But there's another side, and you alluded to it earlier, which is creating a stabilized planet. What does that mean? What do we have to do in order to avoid this hothouse earth reality of no return?
Well, what we suggest in the paper is that we need to keep warming well below 2 degrees and preferably below 1.5 degrees. So how are we going to prevent that sort of warming? Well, we need to rapidly cut greenhouse gas emissions, which would mean decarbonizing our energy system, choosing energy sources that don't produce greenhouse gases. But the other really important point we make is that right now, the biosphere, the planet, takes up quite a lot of the greenhouse gases that we emit, for example, through forests and through the oceans. And the problem with the feedbacks is as we warm the Earth, it makes it more challenging for the forests to take up the greenhouse gases. So one of the things we emphasize is that we need to protect what we call the greenhouse gas sinks, the carbon sinks, like the forests and the oceans, so that they continue to take up greenhouse gases rather than release them. So it's reducing our fossil fuel energy use and some of the other activities that produce greenhouse gases, but it's also protecting the biosphere in order that it helps us absorb the greenhouse gases that we do emit.
Now, of course, what's interesting about this, too, is the political moment that we're in, which is this current administration, the Trump administration in particular, feels very much that this is not an issue. How do you see moving forward without, at least right now, without a lot of support from the administration?
Well, the first thing I would say is this is a global problem. And outside of the US, there are a lot of countries and regions like Europe that are reducing their greenhouse gases significantly. And in Latin America, for example, there's a lot of government initiative to protect forests, to protect the sinks. The other thing is that whatever's going on in Washington, in the federal government, there's a lot of states and cities and businesses in the U.S. that are taking the reduction of greenhouse gases seriously, that do think that climate change is a serious problem. So although our federal government may be backing off on responding to climate change, there are all sorts of other actors around the US that actually mean that our emissions are probably going to go down, even if the federal government isn't supporting that.
Diana Liverman is a geography and development professor at the University of Arizona. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
And that's our show for today. And we're ending the hour by going back to our lead story today about election security. What's going on in your city?
Hello, this is Eric in Monmouth County, New Jersey. I vote on a touchscreen voting machine with no paper trail. I would much prefer a paper ballot dropped in a plastic box.
Hi, my name's Rob from Tarpon Springs, Florida. I wouldn't trust the state of Florida to do anything competently, never mind voting.
Secure voting, I think, is in great jeopardy. From the ease of hacking the systems in place to hanging chads, I'm worried. With all the brain power in America, why can't someone come up with a foolproof method of secure voting? Texas will never put the needed funds to create better or even update current voting systems since there's no monetary benefit. Ann Hout, Texarkana, Texas.
Lots of fantastic opinions from you all, and we still want to keep hearing from you. What do you think about your state's approach to election security? Do you prefer paper ballots, electronic ballots? Do you feel safe going to the polls? Tweet us at The Takeaway, tweet me at Tanzina Vega, or join the conversation on thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.